What should we do when someone has a concussion?
In young women, to donate kidneys doesn't affect their future pregnancies.
Close management of type 1 diabetes and mortality.
And bad luck and cancer.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on January 9th, 2015. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins and president of the Texas Tech University Health Science Center in El Paso and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine. Happy New Year! Good year to you too, Elizabeth.
Thank you so much. That was good. And we didn't even rehearse that simultaneous Happy New Year. So for our first podcast then of 2015, I think they're all so interesting, and I really mean that. In pediatrics then, this idea that when a child has a concussion, an increasingly common problem and increasingly recognized problem, especially on the sports field, gosh, should we keep them in bed longer or roust them out of there?
Since you talked about high school athletes, concussions account for about 10% of their sports-related injuries. And these concussions are otherwise known as mild traumatic brain injuries. They've actually increased about 60% over the previous 10 years. The current recommendation for the child that's had a concussion is that they have 1 to 2 days of rest followed by a slow stepwise return to activity. But the real question is that sufficient or should there be longer periods of rest? Because in animal studies, it shows that if you return to activity earlier, it slows the recovery. So these investigators attempted to answer this question by enrolling 88 individuals who had had a mild brain concussion following a sports-related activity. These were patients aged 11 to 22. They all presented within 24 hours of their concussion, and they were randomized to either usual care, 1 to 2 days of rest and stepwise introduction to activity versus 5 days of rest, and they followed their outcome. And what they discovered, there was no difference in whether their neurocognitive function improved or their balance improved compared to those with the usual care. However, those that were prolonged rest had more post-concussive symptoms, and they had a slower symptom resolution, seemed to delay the recovery. Elizabeth, are you surprised that longer rest actually makes the recovery slower?
I have to say, I absolutely am surprised. And I think a lot of the other folks who've taken a look at the study so far would express the same sentiment. I just wonder what the mechanism would be whereby decreased activity would result in slower brain recovery.
The investigators hypothesized that the deleterious effects may be due to an increase in emotional symptoms. That is, the longer you're at bed rest, the more likely you think, well, maybe I'm not recovering as quickly. So their recommendation is 1 to 2 days of bed rest, stepwise return to activity is better than prolonged bed rest.
It's still really interesting, and it sort of harkens to me, at least, this idea that, for example, in the ICU in patients who've had different types of surgery, we get them up and get them moving. It used to be that we left them in bed for a long time, and then we found out, oops, nope, not such a great idea. Even if you've had coronary artery bypass or you've had a total hip replacement, you're getting up, man, let's go. And I also wonder in these kids if the stimulus that's inherent in getting up and moving around may be helpful with regard to getting the brain to reconnect different things that may have been disrupted.
Yeah, that's a great hypothesis. Now, we don't want to take that to the extension, well, let's get them up immediately afterwards, because it does appear that some time of rest is important for their recovery. But I agree with you, prolonging it really doesn't help.
Not to mention that fractious kids in bed are really no fun at all. Let's turn then from there to a study that originated here at Johns Hopkins. It was published in Science, and it's generated a tremendous amount of interest, suggesting that, gosh, when we take a look at mutations that are accumulated as a cell makes its way toward cancer, that the vast majority of those are random, and that when somebody presents with a clinical case of what we call cancer, there's really not a lot they can do to prevent that.
And that's what I call, quote, bad luck, end quote. Let's take a step back for a second. Bert Vogelstein and his colleague ask a simple question. How much of cancer is driven by environmental factors, things that we have control over, like smoking and how much alcohol we drink, and how much of it's driven by genetics that we don't have any control over? And what they came with is what I think is kind of a novel design, and I think this has generated a lot of the buzz around the study. They said, well, gosh, most of these random genetic changes would take place in cells that divide more frequently. They said if that's the case, those tissues that have more of these stem cells, these cells that rapidly divide and stay around for a long time, should have a higher incidence of cancer. they tried to ascertain for 31 different organs in which the number of stem cells was reported, is there a correlation between the number of stem cells, their division, and the risk of cancer? And what they discovered was, in general, there was. Take, for example, the GI tract. We've got the mouth, we've got the esophagus, we've got the initial part called the small intestine or duodenum, the colon, and there are more stem cells dividing in the colon than there are in the duodenum, the upper part. And sure enough, we have a higher likelihood of cancer in the colon than we do in the small intestine. The reverse is true, by the way, for mice. Now, how much of the cancer is explained by this? Well, according to their calculation, and it is a mathematical calculation, about 2/3 of the risk of cancer are due to these somatic mutations.
This is all really interesting, but I think the point about this study that I would like to emphasize is that it does not mean that we should say, don't worry about what you eat. Go ahead and smoke that cigarette. It's okay if you gain a lot of weight. And it does not mean that. There's still a significant amount of cancer that is relative to the risks that we take.
And I think that's one of the bottom lines. First of all, this is a mathematical model. It's kind of interesting, and it's got a lot of buzz. This assumes that there is no relationship between environmental factors and these somatic changes. That's probably not true either. We should still not smoke, take those risk factors we have control over, and invest our time in that. Now, Bert would say, well, we also need to look at identifying these other genetic mutations and how can we predict those. And I think that's true as well.
Exactly. Developing molecular mechanisms, specifically things that can be discerned in peripheral blood samples, nice, easy sampling technique that might point to this. At least that's my take home. But I agree, it's a lot of fun mathematical modeling, unquestionably. From here, why don't we go to the Journal of the American Medical Association, something that does seem like really bad luck, at least to me. Gosh, we still don't understand why people fully, we don't understand why people develop type 1 diabetes. And these two studies really take a look and say there is an impact on mortality if you have that, but there is also something you can do about it, at least to help to reduce that increased risk of mortality.
Type 1 diabetes typically occurs in juvenile populations, and there's clearly an immune response that triggers this, something that attacks the pancreas cells that make the insulin, and as a result, children are unable to make insulin. What's the estimated life expectancy in the current era in people with type 1 diabetes? There was a Scottish cohort was examined of people with diabetes versus those without diabetes. And what they found is that the estimated life expectancy for patients with type 1 diabetes, there was an estimated loss of life expectancy of 11 years for men and 13 years for women. Some of this is tied to the kidney disease associated with that. They said, well, gosh, if you took out the kidney disease, is there still a decreased life expectancy? And the answer is yes. There was about an 8-year loss of life. The good news is they looked at long-term follow-up in a study in which patients with type 1 diabetes were randomized to tight sugar control, showed that the tighter control was associated with an improved mortality as well.
Well, I would say that at least with type 1 diabetes, my hat is off to the folks who do these things like the camps for kids and all that to help normalize the management of type 1 diabetes and to help these kids really accept the idea that, first of all, hey, I'm not this weirdo down the block. There's a lot of other people who have this particular condition. And second of all, it really is very important to get our arms around keeping that managed really well.
It occurs in juveniles. We're expecting them during their adolescent year to monitor their sugar, to administer insulin, to follow this very carefully. And at that age, we're not really into our health. So you're right. We need to address this aggressively in the U.S. population.
Finally, then, let's turn to the New England Journal of Medicine. There's a look at gestational hypertension, high blood pressure, and preeclampsia in kidney donors.
Until I looked at this study, Elizabeth, I was unaware of the fact that more than 27,000 persons worldwide are living kidney donors. The majority are women, and usually young women. These women often ask, if I give a kidney, will that affect the risk of pregnancy in the future? So it's important, if we're going to give as much information as possible, to get informed consent. This study was a retrospective cohort study of living kidney donors involving 85 women who subsequently donated their kidneys and became pregnant. And they matched them in a 1-to-6 fashion with 510 healthy non-donors from the general population. And what they discovered was that the risk of gestational hypertension at the time of pregnancy, or preeclampsia, that's high blood pressure associated with spilling protein in the urine, was more common in women who were donors, about 11% in that population versus 5% in those who were non-donors. However, there was no difference with the risk to preterm birth or in the risk of low birth weight children. Again, in full disclosure, when a woman says, gosh, I'm going to have a kidney, are there any increased risk? Is basically lay all the risk out.
Okay. Certainly important to establish the full constellation of risk and keep people fully informed. On that note, I'll reveal that I'm going to do the concussions and bed rest on the blog this week. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.